Thank you very much, and I'm very impressed that so many people have made their way through this Battle of Somme here and have found somewhere to sit in this amazing tent. So this is the book that I have written, How to Be a Bad Christian and a Better Human Being, which I suppose raises the question, what is a good Christian? And I suppose really one of the ways I would characterize that is to say that that being a good Christian to me is sort of a bit like painting by numbers, you know? It's when you've got sort of some kind of system that is handed down to you, which gives you a sort of set of parameters and some rules and so on, and you do your very, very best to stick by them. I haven't really been all that good at doing that, I have to say. The fact is that there are millions of people in our own country, let alone across the world, who have lost faith in the picture that is trying to be created in that painting by numbers exercise, but the picture that's offered by organized religion. And yet, I don't believe that those people have given up on religion or on Christianity, on God. In the book, there is a very nice little endorsement that was written by Cole Morton, who says, it's a warm and witty, yes, that's very nice of him to say that. Reading it will help you to understand what's really happening to spirituality in this country, which is more exciting and full of possibility than most of us know. More than that, it will help you to understand what's going on in your soul. And he says, this is written by someone who understands what's going on in the hearts and minds of the millions of us who've given up on church but can't give up on the idea of God. And I think there are lots and lots of people in our country who've given up on religion, they've given up on church. I mean, that's just too evident for words, but who haven't necessarily given up on God, who haven't given up on some kind of spirituality. And they may not use the word God, and they may not use the sort of language that we're accustomed to in churches, but this book is basically saying that I think God is present in many, many, many more people's lives than is really perhaps evident from the surface of things. There's a guy called Michael Meagan, who's one of my heroes, an Irishman who's done incredible work in Africa amongst poor and sick people. And he makes the statement that people today are not looking for doctrine or dogma. We are searching for meaning. And that, I think, is the way in which this sense of the big picture comes across, really. It's about wanting to find a sense of meaning in life. And for that, we need some kind of language to express that meaning or to grapple our way towards it. And the fact is that the language of traditional religion, of traditional Christianity, church-going religion, is no longer communicating to people like Michael Meagan and millions of other people too. You may have read some of M. Scott Peck's works. In his kind of seminal book, The Road Less Traveled, he talks there about the different people who would come into his, he's a psychotherapist, he was, and he talked about the people who had come into the process of psychotherapy with him, and he said that very often people who came into the therapeutic process with no religion at all, with no faith at all, would end up leaving the therapeutic process having found some faith in their lives, having found some kind of more specific journey to go on. But also, he said, he noticed that many people who came into the therapeutic process with a quite clear and specific faith ended up leaving the therapeutic process more as agnostics or even atheists. And he said this puzzled him for quite a while. Same process, same therapist, but quite different outcomes, until he realized that people are in different places, and that for some people to find a spiritual pathway, to find faith in their life, is a really, really positive step forward in their own personal growth. But for other people, to deconstruct their faith, to deconstruct their religion, is also a very positive step in their personal development. And, you know, one may hope that they will find a way back into a reconstructing, a rebuilding. But the fact of the matter is, sometimes losing faith is a positive way forward toward God, because the faith that we have is one that is based on presumptions, on some hand-me-down kind of doctrines and dogma and ideas, rather than something that's rooted and grounded in a real living faith and spirituality. Of course, when people go through the process of losing their faith, losing their religion, friends around them can often be very concerned about this. Parents certainly can be. But other Christian friends may be very concerned, and often it's viewed that this person has backslidden, that they've somehow rebelled against God. And so it's a tricky sort of time to negotiate when you are going through a deconstruction process in your own life, and people that you love and people that love you are feeling that you are somehow walking into the hands of the devil, or, you know, that you're walking away from God or whatever. But sometimes that is what it costs. That's what it means to find a positive way forward. I know for our children, we've got three children who are all grown up now. And I think that we've kind of found out fairly early on in their lives that we weren't really going to be too worried whether they ended up being churchgoers, or even actually whether they shared precisely the faith that we have, that what we were much more concerned about was what kind of people are our children growing up into, what kind of values do they have, what kind of spiritual intelligence do they have in their lives. And I can say that whilst none of our children actually are regular churchgoers, one of them's here today, they are all people that we feel deeply proud of. They are those better human beings that I'm talking about in this book. And I think that all too often Christians have forgotten the fact that following Jesus, first and foremost, should be turning us into better human beings. And somehow that kind of gets thrown away at the side, and it's seen as not being what real Christianity is about. And yet Jesus himself constantly called people not to believe certain doctrines or to accept certain dogma. He called people to follow him, to live in the way that he lived, to adopt the values that he associated with what he called the kingdom of God. And the sad thing is that this kind of painting by numbers, this living by the sort of the Christian rules, if you like, has become so embedded in the culture of many, many churches that when people do find their way on their own pathway, which may involve some deconstruction and so on, that basically they are tormented by, you know, concerned onlookers in the church context. I mean, I think of someone like Jim. For about sort of 18 months, I worked as a chaplain in Mildmay Hospital in the East End of London, which treats people with HIV/AIDS. And Jim was one of the patients who I used to go and see. And on this one occasion, I went to talk to him, and he knew he was dying, and it was not very far away. So I went to visit him on numerous occasions. And on this one occasion, I had a talk with him about his own sort of feelings toward God and so on. And after talking a little while, I just wanted to put my arms around him and hug him. I just felt this kind of uprising of compassion. And as I went to reach out to him, he cringed and sort of pulled back. And he said, "No, no, Father. No, no, don't touch me. I'm unclean." And I said, "Jim, who the hell told you that? Who told you that you were unclean?" And the story unraveled, you know, that he'd grown up in a church in which he had been told, it had been plugged into him again and again, though he had not come out himself at that time, that being a homosexual was to be basically despicable in the sight of God, and that your future was in hell rather than in an eternity with God. And although he couldn't really accept that, he couldn't live by that, and he went down the road of being the gay man that he was, he never really got rid of that underlying guilt, you know, the sense that this is how God sees me, this is how God looks at me. And so here he was now facing death and feeling that he was an unclean man. And it took quite a lot of work and quite a few visits on my part to finally get to the point where I could hug him. And he became a very good hugger, I can tell you, before he died. And he came to see that actually he was acceptable and he was loved and he was embraced by God, regardless of his sexuality. And he found a way to connect with a spirituality that he'd been alienated from by religion, by Christianity. that it sort of made him feel that that was not for him. There was nothing there that was open to him. And he found a way to reconnect with a faith that he never thought he could have again. And so we planned his funeral, and I can tell you it was quite a funeral. And he wanted, as many people do in my experience want, their funeral to end with "My Way." But usually it's Frank Sinatra's "My Way," but in his case it was the Sex Pistols. And it was quite a climax, I can tell you, to this funeral. And those of us who were there, you know, when this came, this song burst in, you know, as I hit the button and the coffin began to move, well, we just laughed and we cried and we laughed and we cried. And there was that sort of sense of joy that I felt that this man had got through the hurdles, the walls that had been put before him by Christianity, by religion, between him and God, and he had found a way to reconnect again. And there are so many people like this. Whilst I was twiddling my thumbs a while back, waiting for a bride to arrive for her wedding at my church, I chatted with a guy called Paul. Paul was a singer who had been hired by the Happy Couple to give what turned out to be a sensational performance of the Luther Vandross song "Always and Forever." And when he entered the church, Paul immediately fell in love with this wonderful deep blue watery painting that we have hanging behind the font, painted by one of our lovely church members, Meg Rowe. And after he looked at this painting, he proceeded to journey around the church admiring all the various artwork that we have in St. Luke's Church. And we ended up having this fascinating and wide-ranging conversation about art and the church, theology and God, and all this was before the bride arrived. And it turned out that Paul had grown up going to church, but left it all behind 5 years earlier. But it wasn't God that he left behind. And so often when people turn away from religion and they seem to have gone away, it's not God that they've left behind. It's an image of God. It's a perception of God, and an experience that is put upon them of God through the church, that is mediated through the church. But I don't believe that this is God at all. And if that is God, then I can tell you quite plainly today, I am an atheist. But it wasn't God that Paul left behind. And in fact, he said that he actually, ironically, felt closer to God and more spiritually alive after he stopped going to church than when he was going. And he was pleasantly surprised to hear me say that I could really understand that I knew what he was talking about. And he said, "I wish I'd met you 10 years ago." Paul felt that the church still treated him like a child, even when he'd grown up. "It was as if I never graduated from Sunday school," he said. "I was expected to take everything they told me as gospel without question, which is okay when I was a kid, but when I was 20, 25, 30. For Paul, his experience of church was all about conformity, painting by numbers, living according to the rules. So when he got fed up with conforming, well, he just upped and left. But he didn't leave his faith behind, far from it. It simply evolved down a different road. But it didn't have the outward appearances that many people would judge as being a good Christian life in terms of going to church and so on and so forth, or being able to say that he believed this, that, and the other doctrine. I really enjoyed meeting Paul. I enjoyed his very vivacious personality, his warm soul, his easygoing spirituality, not to mention his silky smooth voice. And even as we talked, I mourned in my heart afresh that churches so often frustrate, alienate, and ultimately drive away some of their best souls. It seems ironic and devastating to me that an organization whose raison d'etre is to help people grow and mature spiritually sometimes ends up hampering that process, or simply being left behind as something that is irrelevant and having nothing to offer. Some of the most spiritually perceptive people that I know are not regular churchgoers. Many of them, like Paul, have given up going. Others never went in the first place. By the same token, there are dyed-in-the-wool churchgoers whose spirituality, quite frankly, is stunted and infantile. Someone said to me recently, "I don't go to church because it feels like returning to the spiritual nursery." That maybe is harsh, but, you know, it's a sentiment that many people share. And for 10 years in the 1990s, my wife Pat and I ran a group called Holy Joe's. Some of you have heard about it, a church in a pub in South London. And this was a place, I think, for people to come who felt that it was like the spiritual nursery, being a church. They couldn't speak back. It was a place where you're supposed to fit in. You sit down, you shut up, you listen, you do as you're told, you keep the rules, and God will love you and you'll get to heaven. And many people who just long to speak back, to shout back at the preacher, to have their say, to be able to argue and disagree and work it through, felt that there was no place for them to do that in church. And yet, of course, that is how we grow as people. We grow by being able to question, to argue back, to work things through, and Holy Joe's was what is certainly at that time a very rare space in the overall picture of the church where people could do that sort of thing. The fact is that going to church is not the same as being spiritual. And bailing out of church doesn't automatically equate with abandoning faith or spirituality. I recently received an email from a woman in Sydney who says, "I've disconnected from religion to stay connected with God." Now, of course, yes, there are plenty of churchgoers with wonderfully developed spirituality. I'm not denying that. Just as there are church communities where an open and critical approach to faith is encouraged. But sadly, religion and spirituality don't always go together. And we need to understand a little bit of why that might be. And this is the subject which I've dealt with in the fourth chapter of this book. Neurological research, I think, may offer us a little bit of a clue here as to why it is that religion and spirituality don't always equate or go together with each other, with the discovery of another form of intelligence identified as spiritual intelligence, a capacity that is understood now in neurological circles to be hardwired into our brains, linked in part to a mass of neural tissue located in the brain's temporal lobes, which some people have called the God spot. And this is a neural mass dedicated to making us ask fundamental questions of meaning about existence, and to make us search for deep and profound answers to these kind of questions in life. Spiritual intelligence, as I say, has no necessary connection with religion. Going to church doesn't guarantee you're spiritually intelligent, and not going doesn't mean that you are not spiritually intelligent. It operates on a quite different sort of level, independent of religious beliefs, though of course it has a massive bearing on how we interpret our beliefs. And so in many ways, I look back over my life, there are some beliefs which I have had most of my life. And in that sense, there's continuity. But on another level, the way I interpret them and understand them now is totally different. And that's because I have grown and I have evolved in a person in the way that I can interpret some of these historical ideas that have been around in the Christian church. Now, of course, we all know about logical intelligence, IQ, our capacity to process and apply knowledge in a rational fashion. For a long time, this was the only sort of intelligence that was recognized as important or valid. But by the mid-1980s, multiple intelligences were acknowledged, affirming that whilst a person may not have great linguistic intelligence, for example, they may possess enormous musical or physical intelligence. Sometimes you may listen to a remarkable athlete being interviewed, or a great football player, mentioning no names. And, you know, you think they may have phenomenal sporting intelligence, but their intelligence at an IQ level may not be quite so well-developed. And in the 1990s, Daniel Goleman challenged the whole intelligence paradigm by popularizing some neurological research showing that emotional intelligence, EQ, is of equal importance to logical intelligence. EQ provides awareness of other people's feelings as well as our own. It's a way of accessing empathy, compassion, and the capacity to respond to other people's pain or pleasure. It enables us to read people and to read situations at an emotional level, to have some degree of emotional sophistication, if you like. And we know, you know, sometimes you know there are people who emotionally are just completely all over the place. They've no capability to really process feelings and emotions, their own or other people. Whilst there are other people who have this uncanny knack of just being able to process what's going on at an emotional level in a relationship or in a situation. And unlike IQ, which is generally thought to remain fairly static throughout our lives, EQ can be cultivated and improved. There are always ways to develop our emotional intelligence. And then toward the end of the 1990s, neurological research suggested that the brain possessed another basic intelligence that gives us access to deep meaning in life, to fundamental values and an abiding sense of purpose in life. Daniel Zohar and Ian Marshall are leading experts in this field, and they identified this intelligence as SQ, spiritual intelligence. SQ drives us to explore, as I say, the big questions of life. Why am I here? What is the purpose of life? Which path should I follow? Why is there something rather than nothing? What is it that really matters and I make a big priority of? And what are the things that don't really matter very much at all? Spiritual intelligence is all about the big picture. It looks for an overarching sense of meaning to life. SQ is also a capacity that can be cultivated and nurtured rather than something which remains static through our lives. We can improve and grow our spiritual intelligence. So just to repeat this point, SQ, spiritual intelligence, has no necessary connection with religion or religious beliefs. Some people channel their spiritual intelligence through a particular religious tradition, others don't. Atheists and humanists may also have very high SQ, whilst vociferous believers may have a very low SQ. Spiritual intelligence is rooted in structures of the brain that give the ability to form beliefs in the first place, along with meanings and values and purpose. In that sense, it's more fundamental than religion. As a Christian, I'd say that it's part of how we are created in the divine image. And an example of how it doesn't necessarily go together with religion would be a friend of ours called Jenny, who sadly is no longer with us in this world, but she used to come and stay with us regularly at our house when we lived in South London. And she worked in Germany, but when she was over in London, she came to stay with us. And she was, to me, she was one of these, you know, better human beings. She was a beautiful, lovely person who had an enormous amount of kind of concern to make the world a better place, a more compassionate place to live in. And we would often have long conversations into the night, usually over one or two or three bottles of wine. And one particular night, I don't know, it was about 3 o'clock or 3:30 in the morning, and the bottle was nearly empty, whichever bottle it was. And we got to this point where I think Jenny just got uneasy because she felt that there was too much synergy between us. You know, we were just agreeing too much. And she said, "But Dave, you have to remember, I'm an atheist." And I said, "Yeah." "But you're a very spiritual atheist, aren't you?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, yeah." And that was kind of interesting to me, that she could recognize that there was this difference, you know, between her lack of religious beliefs and, you know, her understanding of spirituality. She was a very, very spiritually intelligent person, but who for all sorts of reasons, and in fact, when we really started talking about it, it was the fact that she just struggled with, I think, the perceptions of God that had been handed down to her, that she had received really through the church and through religion in the different ways that it had been communicated to her. So spiritual intelligence, I would say, is thinking with the soul rather than with the mind. And Paul, the young man I mentioned at the beginning, Paul's questioning that unsettled the people in his church was not just at an intellectual level, it came from his soul. He longed for deeper meaning, for deeper answers, and this led him to deconstruct his faith, not in a negative way or for negative reasons, but as part of his inner journey. And when we talked, it was clear that he still held many of his original beliefs, but he held them in a quite different way. He had needed to reconstruct them from a different and bigger framework. So quite legitimately, churches are places where beliefs are taught and affirmed, but they must also be places where spiritual intelligence is affirmed and where it's nurtured. And I wonder how often that is the case. This means creating the space where beliefs can be questioned and doubted and explored in an open fashion, where preachers can be challenged, harangued, shouted at. Feel free. And where things are open to discussion and debate. And I remember this as being such an important part of the development in our own children's lives. I remember journeys in the car when, particularly our oldest daughter, Jenny, who's just got that kind of way about her, you know, that she would just be forever coming up with a million questions. And of course, to me, the delight was that she had the questions, not worrying about the fact that the questions perhaps seemed to be a little bit close to the mark in terms of her belief in God or whatever, but just the fact that there was this kind of growing sense of spiritual intelligence within her. So how tragic that again and again, people whose spiritual intelligence is being quickened and is beginning to stir and to evolve and develop have then been put down or considered to be people who are wandering away from God or being rebellious toward God or losing their faith or whatever. There's no problem with reciting creeds, you know, as classical symbols of faith, provided we can also interrogate those creeds, argue and debate about them, and perhaps write some new ones that grapple with the meaning of faith in the 21st century rather than in the 4th century. Paul's church, the church of this young man, had a dogged commitment to certain Christian beliefs, but precious little developed spiritual intelligence with which to process and interpret those beliefs or allow others to interpret them. And this, for him, became a deal breaker that he just got fed up and he moved away. Paul is really a classic example of what I'm calling a bad Christian. Someone with a fairly well-developed SQ, but a low threshold of tolerance for religious bullshit. Someone with an effective moral compass, but impatient with religious, rigid moral codes. According to Dana Zohar, who I mentioned a moment ago, both IQ and EQ essentially play within the boundaries. Whereas she says that SQ, spiritual intelligence, has a propensity to play with the boundaries. So by its very nature, it's about sort of eroding the clear-cut lines that religion tends to draw and reaffirm and hold to be sacred and very important. So you can see that not only do they not necessarily go together, spiritual intelligence and religion, they can actually be working very powerfully and vociferously against each other. Because the more we develop our spiritual intelligence, the more we want to question the boundaries and play around with those boundaries rather than simply say, we have to stay within these things. You know, yes, we can question things. And there are churches that pride themselves in being, you know, places where you can ask questions. But so often, it is the fact that you can ask questions for more clarification of what is already being said, rather than being able to question what is being said. And I think if churches are going to move on from being these little nursery schools of religion, of Christianity, then they need to be places where people can play around with the boundaries, can get into the sort of dangerous areas, if you like, with regard to faith and spirituality, without everyone being panic-stricken and feeling that the devil is now sort of crawling all over the place and will soon be sort of slipping gently away into hell. So in other words, it's the intelligence, spiritual intelligence is the intelligence that prompts us to criticize or question the status quo. I'm very pleased to say that, you know, some of you were in the launch of this book in the beer tent last night, and I was reading, because Janie Lee Grace, who was interviewing me, sort of said, what do the sort of church authorities think about you writing a book like this? You know, you are a vicar after all. And I said, well, actually, you know, my bishop, the Bishop of London, has written a commendation in here. I wasn't sure he would, actually, but I'm very pleased he did. And this is what he said. In view of what Dave Tomlinson says about religion and conventional church life, I do hope that a commendation from his bishop will not put people off reading a book that is so rich in humanity and written by someone who is a convincing and compassionate pastor, but possibly not a very good member of the Deanery Synod. How did he know? I think he's a clever man, and he knew that was exactly the right thing to say, actually. Because when I was first ordained, actually, it was by Bishop Richard, and when he finally sort of came to the point of agreeing that he would lay his hands upon me, he said, Dave, you're going to find the Church of England very frustrating, and there will be many things that you will be very critical of, but we will benefit from your criticism, which was an amazingly generous thing to say. And I'm glad to say that that's been my experience. I've found I have been able to do that. But you see, this shouldn't be some great pinnacle of kind of achievement that we can accept that. This should be true of every single person that enters the church, that every single person we can in effect say, you're going to be very critical of what you find in here. We expect that, that if you're going to grow and evolve as a person and as a spiritual being, you are going to question what's going on here. And there will be a kind of certain disruptiveness of that. But actually, that's good. That's good for you. That's good for us. That's good for what we're all about. This is really very much at the heart of what I'm talking about as being a bad Christian. So what is it like to think with the soul? What does spiritual intelligence look like in practice? Well, you know, you need to buy the book and you can read about it. But basically, to give you a few headlines, really, it would be qualities that include things like this. Being self-aware, having an understanding of what makes us tick in terms of values and motivations. Now, I'm a teacher of something called the Enneagram. Some of you may have heard of that. It's a kind of system of nine different types of personality, which I'm rather passionate about. And very often when I've been in the context of an Enneagram workshop in this country or elsewhere, and I've watched a process of people who on the face of it are not religious people, and yet I've often felt are deeply spiritual. I've often felt that the process that's going on there as these people are delving into understanding themselves, what makes them tick, how they are different from other people and how we relate together as other people. I've often felt, you know, this is really what church should be like. It should be a kind of like an Enneagram workshop. It should be a place where we are growing a sense of self-awareness and an awareness of other people, because that is part of what spiritual intelligence is all about. Rather than living in a sort of religious fog, which I think is sadly how it often is. Spiritual intelligence means being principled. It means staying true to our deepest convictions and values, even when that means standing against the crowd. It means learning to be spontaneous, living in the moment and responding to what each moment presents. Being empathetic, recognizing the compassion is perhaps one of the most important elements of what it means to be a Christian. Being curious enough to, as I say, put the preacher on the spot, question the basic sort of assumptions within a given context and so on. And there are lots of other things, but basically what all this comes down to is being spiritually intelligent means not living by rules, but living from our hearts and finding God's spirit within ourselves, rather than within a kind of set of rules. Now, rules are important, you know. Kids need rules. We all need rules at certain stages in our life. But being a good rule keeper doesn't mean to say that we are some mature and wonderful human being. It means we're good rule keepers. It means we're conforming. But getting to the point where we understand why, and I always felt with our own children that the important thing is when you shift in the growth of your children from the what, you know, this is what you're going to do because you're here in this house, you know, to this is why this is important. And getting into that process of which children begin to understand the whys and begin to reformulate them for themselves and find their own whys in life is very, very important. But it's equally important in the church, just having a church full of people who all say amen in the right place and wave their hands around and clap their hands when the preacher makes his good point or whatever, which I hope you will do, is not really what matters, but being people who are able to process things and think through things for themselves and sense things in their own soul and arrive at their own kind of convictions about things. And to do that within the context of a community. Some people have felt that what this book's doing is saying the church is unimportant. I'm not saying that. I think that what I really believe is the community is important. And I think that can take many different forms. It doesn't have to be going into a pointy building on a Sunday morning. It can have lots of different applications. I'm not saying the church isn't important, but I think that what I'm saying is that it's not all important in the sense that going to church is any kind of real symbol or sign of the fact that you are really on a spiritual journey, that you are in contact with God and so on. So cultivating these qualities requires firstly a commitment to the inner journey, a willingness to penetrate our own facades and pretenses, to discover more fully who we are and who we want to be. And this can be a joyful and a challenging experience as we uncover our strengths and our vulnerabilities, our potentialities and our brokenness, our higher aspirations and our deeper motivations. Greater self-awareness is absolutely fundamental, I believe, to the spiritual journey. I think that also spiritual intelligence is linked to the development of spiritual practices in our life. A spiritual practice is just a device to help us to be more open and attentive, more open and attentive to ourselves, what it is that we are feeling and sensing inside, more open and attentive to other people, loved ones whose concerns or joys tend to be overlooked very often. An openness and attentiveness to situations, to circumstances, to the world in general. And of course, in and through all of this, to God, who I think is present in all of these things that I've just mentioned. And I think that, you know, as I say, kindred spirits can be very important also in helping us to develop spiritual intelligence. I think that we're made to be members of communities, but those communities, as I say, may take many different forms. No church is perfect, but there are many around that do allow people room, I think, to question and doubt and discover their own way. And I think it's important that that we nurture those kind of communities. There's a young woman called Lucia who lives just around the corner from St. Luke's, where we are. And I can't even remember what it was that brought her through the doors of the church, but she came in and she found a place amongst us, and she had no particular religious background. And she's a good example of someone who returned to church after some years of being away from it, and she discovered a community where her spiritual life flourished. And this is what she wrote to me about it after a short while. She said, "It wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that the re-engaging with a Christian community like St. Luke's has shaken my life to its core. I've learned what it feels like to be part of a group of people with God's love at its center, where I can share and explore my faith with others, but one that crucially respects and values every member. I arrived as someone who felt they'd made a lot of mistakes in their life, but it taught me to let go of all that and look instead to the future, not to ignore the things that my conscience was telling me or allow myself the luxury of ignoring the things that were making me suffer, but ultimately to be embraced as part of who I am. I learned to read the Bible again, not as a rule book for how to live one's life, but as a place among many others to go in search of snapshots of God's wisdom, Christ's courage, humility, and love." And so she goes on. And so I think that the gulf between these two things of Christianity as a faith and spirituality is one that I feel passionate about trying to bridge, trying to bring together. And I think the churches need to be centers of existential spirituality, if you will, places where spiritual lives are nurtured rather than places of conformity. And I think that, you know, if we're ever going to get any of those millions of people out there who never dream of waking up on a Sunday morning and coming to church to be tempted toward our Christian communities, then they need to be convinced that this is going to be an experience, this is going to be a place where their spirituality, where their soul is going to be kind of nurtured and nourished. And sadly, as I say, that is just so often not the case. I've written this book really because I'm fed up really of seeing and hearing representations of God and of Christianity that make me cringe, that I despise, frankly. It seems to me that the wrong people so often seem to grab the microphone, that so often it's people who are giving, for me, hopeless misrepresentations of who God is that seem to be yakking and voicing, their views out there. And I think that it's time, really, that we convince people that this is not at all the sum total of what Christianity is really all about. It's time for some of the rest of us to speak up. And that really, as I say, is kind of partly why I've written this book. I haven't really written it for people who are kind of happy little churchgoers, but I'd be very glad to sell it to them. I've written it for those hordes of people out there who I think do actually have God in their life in some sense, though they may not use that language, who are spiritually hungry. And I believe that there are millions of people who have a great deal of spiritual hunger about them, but they don't for one minute think that Christianity or any other religion or going to church is the way in which to satisfy those often unarticulated longings and yearnings that they feel in their heart. I'm sick of the grumpy old male god of guilt who seems to spend his time looking around to see what people are doing wrong and condemning them, because that's what's conveyed, I think, again and again, to people outside of there. I can't be doing with a God who treats women as inferior and gay people as pariahs. And you can't be doing with him either, apparently, which is absolutely fantastic. You know, on Friday night, some of you may have been at the seminar that I gave then over at Jerusalem, and I finished there by quoting the verse from 1 John chapter 4, which is actually the verse that is the opening sentence of the Anglican marriage service, which says this: those who live in love, God is love, God is love, and those who live in love live in God, and God lives in them. And I love this statement because I feel it's one of the most inclusive statements in the entire Bible. But it expresses really the heart of what I feel in my deepest, deepest being, that this is what God is about to me, not that grumpy old God of guilt, not the God who makes a dying man, you know, in a hospital in East London feel that he is despised and hated and rejected by God, not the God who seems to not be able to see any proper place for women in the church on an equal footing with men and all of that kind of crap, you know. I believe in a God of love, and I believe that those who do truly love live in God, and God lives in them. And I hope you believe that, and that you will communicate that as strongly and as powerfully. Grab that microphone and get that message across, so that we can just change the balance of how people perceive what the Christian faith is all about in this country. Amen.
So we have a little time now for questions. There's a microphone, which you can just about see just here. If there's a particular question you would like to ask Dave, you'd like to come up and line up in front of that microphone. So please don't be shy. Do come through the quagmire, if you can, to the front. Just to say two things just before we have some questions. Firstly, Dave will be signing this new book in the Greenbelt Bookshop at 7 o'clock tonight. So if you'd like to buy a signed copy, then please do come there. But also to let you know, if you're into beer, Hodder actually sponsored Bad Christian beer in the organic beer in the beer tent. So if you'd like one of those, please do. So, questions, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Firstly, thank you very much. I just wanted to ask a bit more about how you can help us put this into practice. I read a quote recently from a psychologist who said something very similar, that we should assume that everybody has a spirituality, but it's about how to ask the right questions and help them explore that. And I think if you come through an evangelical background, you've kind of been taught how to engineer conversations towards Jesus and the church. But I find I want to help people explore their spirituality, but don't quite have sort of the language and the questions to help them do so. So I was wondering if you could say in your experience, you know, what kinds of things we can usefully ask people, what kind of language to use, which will actually help them open up on these issues.
Okay, I think, is that on? Yeah, you hear me? Yes. I think there are sort of various levels in which you know, I could answer that question. I mean, from the point of view of the church, I think the churches, as I said a moment ago, need to shift away from being these kind of places of uniformity and conformity to more open communities where people can sort of question and explore and doubt and go through all of that sort of, you know, process more freely and more helpfully. And I think that means that churches probably need to be kind of more umbrellas under which all kinds of things are going on. And we shouldn't worry about whether they come to church on Sunday. I spend a lot of my time telling people, I don't think God cares whether you come to church. You know, obviously I'm a vicar, I'd like you to, but I don't think that, you know, that is the crucial thing. But you know, I think that churches need to become more sort of centers for spirituality, where there are things, I mean, like the Enneagram that I've talked about, you know, where there are things which are not necessarily sort of putting a religious thing onto people, but opening up spiritual kind of pathways, so that, and that might be using art or you know, it could be all sorts of possible ways in which people can explore their deeper selves and their spirituality without feeling that they are having to accept certain religious dogma in the process of doing so. So, I mean, I think that, you know, that raises a whole lot of questions, I know, in itself, how we can do that. But I think that is an objective that we need really to move toward. But I think that, you know, it's having context in which soulful conversations can go on. And that was what we did by starting Holy Joe's, by a group in a pub. But it doesn't have to be that. I think it can happen over a dinner party. I think it can happen, you know, in all sorts of social context, where you just create some space where people can have a soulful conversation, you know, can talk about things. And they're only going to do that, I think, if they know that this isn't a subtle way to try and get them to say, I accept Jesus into my heart or something, you know, or come to church. But I think it's, you know... there are so few places in our world, in our culture, where people can really sort of open up and sort of, you know, engage in that kind of journey and conversation. And I think that's what we need to try and nurture much more.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I could ask you to keep your voices down so that people can hear. If you are talking and not interested, could I do ask you to leave the venue so that people can actually hear what Dave is saying? Thank you. Next question.
Hi. I'm an atheist. I somewhat identify with the idea of being a spiritual atheist, but I would quite like you to try and define spirituality a bit. You used it an awful lot in your conversation, and you know, things. I think you can pick up where you're perhaps going with that, but I felt you didn't really quite define it enough for me.
Right.
And I'd be really quite interested to just to hear a little bit more about what you think a spiritual an atheist with an SQ might really look
right.
like.
I think it's obviously a very difficult thing to entirely put your finger on, sort of give a snappy little kind of answer to that question. But to me, I think spirituality is about kind of connectedness. It's about a kind of interconnectedness. So that if we think of the different sort of parts of a person's life, you know, their physical life, their material life, their emotional life, their mental kind of life, their relationships and all these things. That spirituality isn't to me, just another one amongst those, a thing amongst things. I think it's the thing between, if you see what I mean. It's the thing that kind of connects them together and gives a sense of profundity, a sort of sense of meaning and an overall, overarching sort of sense of connection between all those other parts of our life. So in a sense, it's the kind of space between the things rather than being another thing. Whereas I think that if you associate it very much with religion, then it becomes another thing amongst the things. It's kind of an activity that you do, or beliefs that you subscribe to, or whatever that might be. Whereas I think it's to do with this sort of sense of connectedness that gives an overarching or an over sort of riding sense of meaning and purpose to our lives.
Thank you.
Hi, I just wanted to ask your opinion about how religion is dealing with the conflict between science and religion. And I think this is a real problem with young people, is that they're getting a very different story from their teachers and from university education.
Yes.
And I don't see it being addressed greatly in our... in churches, or and that's stopping people getting to this point of spirituality.
Yeah, I think it's one of the devastating legacies of a lot of religion, a lot of Christianity, churchianity, is this kind of dichotomy, this separation between faith and science. And we obviously see the extreme forms of it, particularly in American society, where we've got this, very, very strong lobby of creationists, over against kind of, theory of evolution and so on and so forth. But it's still present, I think, in many churches who aren't necessarily locked into that debate in a narrow sense. And, I think that, This view of spirituality that I've just got is, as I say, it's to do with connecting the various bits of life and to recognize that the whole academic and intellectual sort of enterprise that is encompassed by, things like in the world of science, say, is an important aspect of our humanity. And I think part of the way in which God's being is unfolding and being revealed to us in the world is through science, religion in the narrow specific sense, yeah, maybe that does give us some insights from a traditional sense about God, but science is another whole area that can tell us profound things about God, and I believe that's true also of the social sciences, of art, of the aesthetic kind of dimensions of life and so on. All of these, they shouldn't ever be sort of put in opposition to or being given any kind of over against the Christian faith or any sort of religion, but seen to be essential parts of our humanity. And the spiritual journey, whether it's within Christianity or any other religious tradition, needs to be a way of bringing together these different aspects and giving a sense of kind of unity and overall sense of meaning and purpose to these things. So, I think it's just devastating, I think, that young people who are growing up in churches where there is a dichotomy between, science and faith are then thrown into this terrible conflict when they go to university or whatever, and they suddenly feel that, that this is a worldview which seems to be so much more compelling than the one that they've heard in church. And so they feel they've got to leave that one behind and go on to that one. And it just makes me so angry, because this is not how it is at all. God's world is the whole bang lot. And I think that, I can learn about God as much by listening to the unfoldings of scientific research as I can from reading the Bible. These are not either ors. These are all part of a whole.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Next question.
I was wondering how you feel by the hijacking of Christianity by politicians and politics, especially locally. Find a lot of local sort of hijacking of it. How do you feel about it, and what should we do about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that fortunately, in one way, it's not as big a problem here as it is across the pond, you know, because I think religion has slipped off the agenda so substantially here that it isn't necessarily a good thing for a politician to hijack religion. That may stand against him or her. Whereas in America, I think the religious lobby is still extraordinarily powerful and influential. But yes, I mean, I think it's another one of those things that really makes you so angry. I mean, I think it's important to say, in the light of what I've just said, that I think politics is another part of the wholeness of life. So I'm not thinking that we should divorce politics from our faith. But I think that when particular kind of party politics are used to hijack a particular religion, you know, in order to substantiate their position, then I think that this, you know, is certainly one of the evils in modern political life. And I think is also a huge source of discrediting the Christian faith and religion in general as well.
We have time for two more questions.
Right. I come from a gospel evangelical background. And some Christians said to me in the past, when I was with someone, it's like a dog. It's in the Bible. It's like a dog will go back to his own vomit, and I don't know where that comes from.
Okay, well, and Robert actually was in the book launch last night. Those of you there may remember, and he was sharing how he is part of an evangelical church. But has developed a relationship a while back with a young man called Mark, and he was told in his church that he had to choose between Mark and Jesus, that he couldn't have the two. And Robert was sort of sharing how, with great reluctance, that he felt that he had to choose Jesus rather than Mark, and this had broken Mark's heart as well, and so on. And I think that, you know, when church leaders throw around these sort of phrases from the Bible, like, you know, the dog returned to his vomit and all that, I mean, it's about sick, and it makes me sick, you know, because these are just coercive ways to quote Bible verses to make people conform, to make them live by the rules, you know, instead of living from their hearts and from, I think, the voice of God's Spirit within them. So, you know, it all fits into what I said earlier, but I don't think that he had to choose between Jesus and Mark necessarily, and I don't think anybody else has to face that kind of choice either.
And our final question for this session.
Thank you.
Thank you for your description of spiritual intelligence and the idea that spiritual maturity can be developed over time. I was just interested about how churches might be able to kind of develop that spiritual maturity, with the acknowledgement that people are at different levels, if you like, with the idea that actually the gospel is about having a schema of how we know God through God's grace revealed to us in Jesus. So how do we kind of help kind of people who are exploring Christianity to actually kind of teach them about God's grace revealed to us in Jesus, but at the same time nurturing all Christians wherever they are in their spiritual maturity?
Yeah. I think, you know, I mean, there's so many answers to this question. I haven't got the time. But one of them would be this, that I think that the crisis of faith that I often find I'm involved with helping people through is because they have started off in a Christian faith which basically said, these are all the answers to all of your questions. Ba-dumph, you know. And then they come to this point, through whatever process it may be, where all that begins to unravel, and then they're looking for a way to try and reconstruct their faith. And I've seen, you know, again and again, people in awful traumas of trying to kind of work all of this thing through. I think that, you know, churches need to be places where people from the very beginning of their spiritual journey are introduced to the idea of living the questions, rather than sort of sitting there and just receiving the answers, you know. So I think that however we do it, there are lots of different ways, there are lots of formats which this can be done. But we need processes in churches in which people can actually really learn to ask questions, in which perhaps rather than simply being given nice, reassuring pastoral answers to things, more questions are thrown at them, you know, to unsettle things even more, to make people have to sort of think through for themselves were they sort of stand on this or that or the other? I think the other side of it, in terms of sort of, you know, things like spiritual practices, again, this has all become so formularized, you know, that prayer is given us as this kind of little, you know, pre-packed sort of box, and this is how you're supposed to pray, this is what prayer consists of, this is what worship is, this is what, you know, and I think that, you know, we need to open that whole thing up and to learn from many different sources and traditions about different ways, different practices through which we can, you know, evolve, you know, our spirituality. So you know, there may, you know, you may still have a particular main Sunday service, let's say, in the conventional church that has a particular format to it. But I think that, you know, with it, under the umbrella of the church, we need to have lots of different kind of spaces and settings where people can explore and grow. In a way, though, you know, I mean, I think I said in a previous seminar that one of my kind of models for church leadership, for being a vicar, would be based on the good pub landlord, you know, the welcoming, warm, congenial sort of guest who's got good stuff to serve up from the pumps, you know. But I think also it needs to be modelled on good parenting, you know. And I've mentioned, you know, how we have approached parenting, and I think it's that sort of rather than having the overbearing parenting, which is controlling and requiring conformity, which then ends up with these enormous great rebellions all over the place because it can't be held onto forever, which has an equivalent in the way that people go through process, you know, through crises of faith and so on. We need to have a much more kind of facilitating, supportive form of parenting as a style of leadership in the church that is creating space for people to find themselves, to be themselves. You know, as I say, it's just awful, I think, that people end up feeling that pleasing God means conforming to this particular model of what it means to be a Christian. We're all different. We're all individuals. I know someone's going to stand up in a minute and say, I'm not. But, you know, we're all individuals. And I think true community can create a sense of unity whilst allowing us still to evolve and develop our own individuality. And I think, you know, if we're going to sort of really break through from this malaise that we have and this dying culture of church, we need to create different kinds of spaces where people can enjoy community with all that that brings, but also find themselves as individuals before God and grow and evolve, you know, in their faith, in terms of questions, in terms of spiritual development, and so on and so forth.
Thank you.